So, we ended the last lecture, just a brief reminder, discussing that projective measurements are not great, and perhaps we should be careful when we model measurements with projective measurements. Sometimes they may work, and that's why people use them, because there are systems and situations for which they actually are a good description for a measurement. But in general, projective measurements kind of treat detectors in general in a different kind of realm as quantum systems. And we discussed how actually a much better way of considering measurements is by considering the detectors themselves as quantum systems that couple to the probe system. Now, we also discussed that when it comes to quantum field theory, things are much worse. And by much worse, I mean, well, not only we have the usual problems that you inherit from quantum mechanics with projective measurements, projective measurements in quantum fields destroy the causality of the theory. So they're incompatible with our relativistic formulation of quantum mechanics. So interesting enough, the projective measurements in quantum fields is not, again, and super important to say this, is not because we are being naive in the S matrix kind of naivete, right? In the S matrix kind of approach, people consider that they measure in, if you want, eigenstate of the, well, the S matrix is plagued with problems. One of them is that they consider that the eigenstates, the basis in which they measure at the end, are eigenbases of free theories. Whereas, for example, even QED, right? If you have QED, if you measure the electromagnetic field, that thing is always coupled to fermion charge fields. So it's not true that you can actually measure in eigen. It's not a physical thing. When you measure an energy of some state of the field, you're not quite measuring anything related to a free Hamiltonian of the field, right? But that's a different problem. Even so, people would say, well, we kind of do an approximation with in which we measure on like basis of eigenstates, or we measure the observable free energy of the field. And of course, that thing is completely localized. Things, states of the field that have definite energy are completely localized. So maybe that's why you're violating causality in a way, because you are kind of projecting on things that live everywhere, non-local. But that's not the problem. Is worse than that, and that's what Raphael Sorkin was pointing out. Even if you do localize, so when people talk in quantum fields and they tell you, oh, we have a local algebra of observables, an observable that lives here, and then we measure this observable, that is wrong, that's very wrong. If someone ever tells you we measure this observable and don't specify, they use like a measurement in which they find some classical information or some information about the state of the field here, that thing, in the sense of projective measurements, if we apply an update rule on that, destroys the causality of the theory. So even localized projective measurements. A typical example or a modification of one of the examples that Sorkin gives. Sorkin elaborates way more. And then if you read this one, there's even more on this. But imagine that you consider a localized projective measurement happening in some region of space-time here. Say A, Alice, carries out a projective measurement that is localized in space and time. And of course, you have Bob here outside of the light cone of Alice. And of course, if you do something like this, Alice is only touching the field in here. So whatever Alice does on the field propagates, of course, causally. So you don't get any of what Alice does go to Bob, for sure, that doesn't happen. So Bob, if Bob does a projective measurement here, Bob cannot figure out what happened with Alice. So in that sense, he's fine. But then you can introduce an observer C that does something in this area of the field, call it a projective measurement, call it a unitary operation, something that is localized in between. It could be even at the limit of the light cone. And this operation that C does enables B now to find out about what Alice did. So it is possible, I mean, this is a very simplified example, but it is possible to make B realize of what's happening on A by just considering people C that have a causal connection with A and with B. And you can it can be two people locally, one here and one here, and then this one on the boundary of the light cone. So anyway, please check the papers for details. This is hand-wavy as hell, so I would not recommend you to believe that, but that's kind of the gist behind it. So any questions about that? That's yesterday. All right, so today we're going to say, OK, but then we know that people do measurements on quantum fields, right? Those things exist. We get papers from CERN telling us that no evidence of minimal supersymmetry. Oh, we found the Higgs and things like that, right? People measure things, and they reveal, they make measurements and they publish the data, and the data has impacts on how much we believe in one theory with respect to another, and so on. Hmm? And people even talk about particles, which is super dangerous, but they do talk about particles. So how do they actually measure quantum fields? How can we model? From the theory point of view, I mean, from the experimental point of view, it's kind of easier if you want, but what does that mean? How do we model in our quantum field theory the process of measurement quantum fields? So let me introduce the notion of particle detectors. What are particle detectors? So let's see. Particle detectors are the things that measure quantum fields. So things that you can think of them as you couple it to a quantum field and the thing clicks, click, click, click. Right? And then when there's a click, maybe you can declare if it's a particle detector. By definition, you can declare, oh, I detected a particle when it clicks. You know, so the detector changes its state depending on the state of the field. There's some system that correlates with the field. Now, they have to have several traits, and let's analyze a little bit what traits we want from particle detectors. We definitely want them to be quantum, as in like we don't want to have the problem of projective measurements. And the problem of projective measurements in QFT, which is even worse. So I want to model my detectors quantumly. All right, they're quantum systems. They have to be localized, as in like, well, I want to have a detector in a region of space, and I want to switch it on and off for a finite amount of time, right? So I want them to be localized in space and time. That seems reasonable. I would say so. If you think that something is not reasonable or too demanding and so on, please do interrupt. OK. B, we need them to couple to quantum fields, right? Otherwise, how are they going to find out about the field? We need some coupling. We need some Hamiltonian, if you want, that couples the detector with the field. We also need them to be non-relativistic. And why? Well, actually, I should have probably written C before D, because C is related to D. Let's go with D first. We can measure them. As in like, OK, we have this quantum system that couples to the field. It could be a whatever, a photomultiplier that you use to detect something on the field. But then you should be able to wire a computer, and the computer will tell you, oh, yes, 42 clicks per second. See? You should be able to measure them, to get a number, to get a classical, I mean, whatever, to get a number out of it, right? To get a 42, or to get a 7, or things like that. You should be able to measure them. And if we want to measure them and use the formalism we know for measurements where we actually go from quantum to a number, we should be able to do things like measurements, as in projective measurements, or at least something that looks like idealized measurements in the detectors. And because of that, we need them to be non-relativistic. Because if, I mean, we know that there are some systems for which projective measurements work well, and some scenarios for which works well. I mean, people can do projective measurements on, say, atomic states and see if it's excited or ground or what orbital they are, and they're a good model, and that's why they were introduced. If we want not to have problems with the causality of the theory, we need them to be non-relativistic. So we need to find, and by non-relativistic, I mean they can have relativistic trajectories. Obviously, everyone has relativistic trajectories, right? What's a relativistic trajectory? Does anyone want to say what a relativistic trajectory? If I tell you, is my trajectory relativistic, what would you say? Yes or no?
No.
Why not?
You're going pretty slow.
Ah, OK, according to who? See what I mean? Like, for you, I might not be very relativistic, but that's a frame-dependent statement, how relativistic I am in the sense of how fast you go. By non-relativistic, I mean their internal energy levels come from some non-relativistic assumptions. For example, hydrogen atoms. Hydrogen atoms you can describe pretty well with considering like Coulomb kind of interactions and kind of Galilean or Newtonian, if you want, kinetic terms in them. So a non-relativistic approximation, of course, we would like to think that atoms are also made of excitations of quantum fields. But no one in atomic physics used that because we don't know how to solve that. The thing is non-perturbative and tough. So we need at least to have a non-relativistic description that works for those systems. And I'm talking about the internal energy levels, not the center of mass degrees of freedom. Questions about this? Thank you, by the way. That's good. All right. Cool. So This is the kind of systems that we use to measure quantum fields. Do you people agree? That's what we have. Hydrogen atoms are an example. Atoms, hydrogen-like atoms, are, for example, the sensors in LHC, there are made CCD cameras, photomultipliers. All those things are made of matter that is non-relativistic, that has internal levels, internal degrees of freedom, that get excited through coupling to the fields. And then we acknowledge those excitations by measuring them with other means. Agreed, people? This is the way we measure quantum fields, from the LHC to our retinas. That's the way we do it. All right, so let's try to make this a little bit more rigorous. I can tell you that particle detectors were initially introduced as something like that, not trying to measure anything realistic. And that was Andrew and DeWitt, who both introduced models like this. But let's take a different perspective. Let's try to obtain particle detectors from first principles. So let's see. The light matter, let me call it that. This is a just name for light here means quantum fields. Matter means non-relativistic detectors, OK? Interaction. This is the language from quantum optics, by the way. Because we're going to kind of take a hit on quantum optics. That's going to be fun, hopefully. The light matter interaction from first principles. How many of you have heard anything about quantum? Have they seen quantum optics, BSI students?
Kind of. There was like one lecture about it in September.
Yeah, quantum optics was actually developed by people who knew a lot of quantum field theory. What happens is that in the lab, actually, people didn't know to use all that and started doing approximations. And there are many ways in which those approximations are, let me just say, quote-unquote, forgotten nowadays. And we're going to try to understand where we're going to go back and derive the light-matter interaction for first principles a little bit more modern than when Milani and other people did it.
Actually, before you move on to that, so with the...
Loud, please, I can hear.
With the particle detector, so you said this was developed by Unruh and...
The notion of quantum optics is older than the notion of particle detectors.
Glauber in the 60s had
detectors like that. So the Glauber model also violates causality, though. Okay. So when I talk particle detectors, I'm going to do things that are coming from the field theory side of things. And when they introduced this, they weren't thinking of like matter, this link I'm making here. The particle detectors were introduced just to have a means to locally measure fields. And in fact, they were introduced for the first time to give a non-controversial derivation for the Andrew effect. Mm-hmm. Because the first derivation, the one that you are going to do, actually, the PSI students are those who come in a tutorial, that one is controversial. We will discuss it a little bit.
So what's specifically different about the Glauber detector?
They were developed independently. The Andrew DeWitt detector, for example, generalizes the Glauber detector.
Okay.
But they were developed in parallel and not talking with each other, which is super interesting. So when you talk to Andrew about particle detectors and Andrew DeWitt, he's like, oh, light, I don't care. Light, who knows how to describe that? I mean, he wouldn't say that because he knows. But the idea is like, I don't care. What I want is something that in theory allows me to do measurements on a field. That was the reason they were introduced. And not trying to describe the light-matter interaction. It so happens that the Andrew DeWitt generalizes the models that people use in quantum optics. But we will get there from first. So the idea here is to take a different route because we know better nowadays, right? Let's look at the light-matter interaction to begin with and see if we can. Because I told you that hydrogen-like atoms are kind of good particle detectors, no? They have the features that we want. So let's try to get to explain really how a detector, a hydrogen-like atom, couples to the electromagnetic field. Let's discuss that to begin with. So I'm going to take the quantum optics route. But quantum optics, as like first kind of quantum, like when people started doing quantum optics, like Milani, Glauber, and all these people, Maria Goeppert-Mayer, and all those people that developed the proper theory, let's say, of quantum optics. Okay, so let's consider an electron in a hydrogen-like atom. By hydrogen-like, I mean it doesn't have to be one proton and so on. It could be any kind of atom that is, let's say, only one electron to simplify things. So This is something that you've done in your basic quantum mechanics, wherever you took that for the first time, very likely. And you say, oh yeah, sure. The Hamiltonian for that electron, you write, oh, this is p squared, as an operator, of course, 2m plus evx, right? And then you say, OK, this v is a Coulomb potential, right? And this is the kinetic, if you want, energy of the electron. And then you solve the Schrödinger equation associated with that, and you end up with, in the position representation, you get the orbitals, et cetera, right? Agreed? That you've done this, everyone, no? OK. So the next step is saying, OK, let's say that the electron in that atom couples to an electromagnetic field. That's kind of tricky, and we will discuss that more, because all the gauge aspects of the theory are kind of like swept under the carpet, and we will discuss that later, because it's non-trivial and not innocent at all. But let's say there's an electromagnetic field, and the electron couples. And you could say, and this is why the sweeping happens, but isn't it already coupled to electromagnetic field? Like the Coulomb potential is kind of, no. What I mean electromagnetic field, I mean a full relativistic electromagnetic field that satisfies Maxwell equations, something that is time dependent. So you have a time dependent electromagnetic field outside, and the electron couples to it. Let's say this is a good description. But of course, that electron, if you kind of bombarded with an electromagnetic field, the electron is going to see that field. So what's a Hamiltonian in that case? So say the electron couples to the EM field. How does it couple? What's the coupling, the Hamiltonian that couples an electron in an atom with the electromagnetic field? You guys remember? So there's only one way of actually doing it that is respectful, if you want, with the symmetries of spacetime, and that's called the minimal coupling Hamiltonian. Have you heard about it? Minimal coupling Hamiltonian is basically, right, the canonical momentum is going to be modified, so p is not going to be any more p. It's going to be p corrected with some connection. Anyway, let's just write it up. Hp minus E of Tx. Squared divided by 2m plus perhaps a scalar potential that is time dependent, of course. So you have E to the U Tx. And of course, you still have the Coulomb static potential that constructed your hydrogen atom. How many people have, you know, how many people have not seen this before? OK, good. So this is the minimal coupling Hamiltonian. You can prove that that's the only way to couple the, well, I mean, nothing like a vector field. That's the only way to couple a vector scalar, four vector field to a charge that is respectful with the symmetries of spacetime. OK, so. Here's the thing, no, like this thing, as you see, it's a bit funny, no? Oh no, let's expand this parenthesis and see what happens. So if we expand, let's just move this a bit up. Let's expand this. If we expand this product, we get this. P squared divided by 2m. Plus E V of X, and then this is gonna run in the way, yeah? All right. Plus or minus E over 2M P times A T X plus A T x dot p plus e to the u t x. All right. So what we have here is we have some let me call it free Hamiltonian. That would be the Hamiltonian of the hydrogen atom if there were no electromagnetic field outside. Agreed, people? And we also have this thing. I'm missing one thing. Sorry about that. I'm missing definitely plus E squared divided by 2m A dx. This thing, let's call it an interaction Hamiltonian, because it describes the coupling of the electron with the electromagnetic field. Everyone happy with that? All right. So here are the things. So what should I do first? Maybe let's do first, what's done as a first attempt in quantum optics without thinking twice about it. Keep in mind that it took like 20 years to figure out in quantum optics how to do this right. So let's do what people did. People said, and then of course, let's put everything in a parenthesis because it's gonna be wrong. But let's just do what people did at the beginning. Huh. So this thing is funny because it's kind of, well, it's complicated to begin with. It's got a quadratic field term. That is tough, because a quadratic field term introduces horrible things like divergences and things like that in my evolution. I don't want that. I don't see normal ordering or anything. It's a quadratic term in the field. Those things are tough. If you don't quantum field theory, you know these things are half divergences, UV divergences in three dimensions, 3 plus 1. There's also the problem that this thing is complicated. This is an operator, of course. This is also gauge dependent. But OK, they didn't care much about that at the beginning, or most people didn't. So they said, OK, let's do the following. Well, it's gauge dependent, but in the end, nothing has to depend on gauge. So let's simplify this. So pick the Coulomb gauge. OK? And by doing that, the nice thing about the Coulomb, there are two nice things about the Coulomb gauge. Number one, in this gauge, U of Tx, do you guys remember the Coulomb gauge? What's the potential in the Coulomb gauge? It's zero. Or this is zero. And also, A of Tx happens to now commute with P. In this particular gauge, those things are true. And well, then the Hamiltonian simplifies a lot. And then the Hamiltonian H becomes H0 plus, and then we get E over M P times A of Tx plus E squared 2m A squared Tx. All right. Agreed, everyone? Yeah.
Is there a minus sign missing?
Thank you. This is the whole problem of, is E positive or negative? But yes, thank you. I will make those mistakes, and I appreciate this. Right, and they said, well, we still have the problem. So this has simplified quite a bit. I don't have the potential term, the scalar potential term. I don't have the commutator in here. So the anti-commutator in here, I have only one term. There's one thing, though. I don't like this. But then they say, hold on. But look at this. This thing is going to be small, this coupling parameters. You see, this is only the atom. This couples the atom and the field. The momentum of the electron is coupled to A. And this is a quadratic term without field. If you want, there's an identity on the, this couples the x degree of freedom of the electron, the center of mass degree of freedom, with the field in a funny way. Not in a super direct way like this, which is kind of nice. Huh? This is an operator, of course. But they said, oh, look, but this one, this thing should be small because in nature it's small. This thing is quadratic, right? So actually, my detector is not going to see anything about the field until third order in expansions on E. Do you people agree? The reason is that, well, this thing alone is going to change the state of the field is of the order E squared, this changed, whatever this does, and then it's gonna be felt by the detector through this term. So that's at least order 3. So they did, okay, neglect. Because this is small. But hold on, didn't you say that there are divergences? How can you neglect something because it's small in front of something that's infinite? Don't ask me that. This is not. And then the model called the, in quantum optics, this is known as the P times A Hamiltonian, which says, oh yeah, yeah, the coupling between the atom and the field, the electron in the atom and the field goes through a term P times A. Yes?
Are we treating A as classical background?
For now, yes.
So we still get divergences for the quadratic term?
Good point. It will get the divergences once you quantize it. Yeah, yeah, definitely. So we keep in mind we want to do in the end something like quantum optics. So we will have to quantize A.
Okay.
So they want to build first. Let's do it. I could have done it quantum from the beginning, but I prefer to do it at the end, not to mix things. Because you need much more extra functional analysis to justify that everything works if the things had hats already in the A. Because it's not the same kind of hat. So let's do the canonical quantization at the end. They commute in this case, so no problem. I could actually do the rigorous way the other way as well, as in like quantize first and then couple. But the problem, again, you pointed it out very well, this thing, when you quantize, is when you will get problems. When you do the second quantization. This is really where the name comes from, first quantization and second quantization, because you do one before and then the other. Anyway, right, so this is, again, the P times A kind of Hamiltonian. And there's a problem with this. And the first problem that people realized is that, oh damn, if I actually, you know, people said, oh nice, let's compute transition probabilities of atoms, you know, probability of getting an atom excited and things with that. And they realized that the probabilities they were actually taking the position representation, writing up the orbitals and so on. They were having the problem that the transition probabilities were gauge dependent. As in like, they didn't quite care at the beginning because they already picked the Coulomb gauge. So there's nothing that tells you it's gauge dependent. The thing is that if you actually go here and pick a different gauge, and you transform to a different gauge, you get something different for the amplitudes of probability. And that's not so surprising because here's the thing, people. In quantum mechanics and in quantum field theory, many times we use the name observable liberally. This Hamiltonian, many people would say, oh, this Hamiltonian represents the energy of the system, right? Can it, though? No, it can't, because the energy of the system, we think of things that are observable and measurable. This Hamiltonian is explicitly gauge dependent. This Hamiltonian is not physical. It is. So you see, you have to reconcile these two things. The Hamiltonian that couples the electromagnetic field with an electron written like this is correct and yet unphysical. In the sense, by unphysical, I mean, it's definitely the generator of time translations. So in that sense, it's the right Hamiltonian in that sense. It's the thing that will evolve states of atom and field towards the future. It generates time translations. But it's not a physical energy at all, because it's a gauge-dependent object. All right? Now, what needs to be gauge-independent is not the Hamiltonian. Many times you read in books that, oh, we pick the Hamiltonian so that the eigenstates are gauge-independent and so on. That's just what needs to be gauge-independent is the things that are really observable. Transition probabilities should definitely be gauge-independent. And they are if you do things right. We will go back to this after we finish the model, right? Well, after we take another step. But you see what the problem seems to be? This is kind of dirty in many ways. We have a Hamiltonian, and this is correct, though. The Hamiltonian is not the energy, because it's gauge-dependent. It's the right Hamiltonian, as in, like, it's the thing that exponentiating will give me the right time evolution. It's not gauge-independent. And you, in order to compute with it, you did a couple of things here that don't seem quite like fixing a gauge and neglecting that. And you may say, what is wrong with fixing a gauge? And I would say, nothing, but you have to fix it right. And I'm not sure if they fixed it right here. Well, in fact, I know they didn't fix it right, but we will discuss that later. Okay, so people were doing that on one hand. On the other hand, other people looked at the same problem, and in fact, we have here now Maria. Mayer, Nobel Prize in Physics for the layer model in nuclear physics. She came out with a way of doing this better. And the way is like, okay, cool. Take the Hamiltonian there, and let's express it explicitly in terms that are gauge independent. So let's write this in terms of gauge independent variables. So write H in terms of E and B. So to do that, you go here and you fix gauge in here, which you can, no problem. If you do it right, and we will discuss what doing it right means, because I cannot do it only half of what I should do. So Maria Gopermeyer says, okay, let's fix something called the multipolar gauge. You may have heard about, you probably may have heard about the multipolar gauge called the Poincaré gauge. I don't know if you heard those words before, but he said like, okay, pick the Poincaré gauge and carry out a multiple expansion. So do two things. Pick the Poincaré gauge in there, and then expand in multiples, as in like you have vector fields, and you have, well, you know that the solutions of the hydrogen atom have defined angular momentum, and you can actually take expansions in multiples. That's the typical spherical harmonics expansions that you make out of the solutions of the hydrogen atom. In the field, you're going to have terms of the form e to the ix k. And those terms, you can expand in spherical harmonics as well. So basically, you do a multiple expansion on those terms. I'm not going to get into details of that particular thing. It's long and just boring in the sense of, like, you know how those things, have you ever done calculations like that where you have like 3J symbols and they're long and there's nothing really to learn out of doing them? Let's just say that we do the multiple expansion and we fix the Poincaré gauge to the multiple expansion. And then Mary Gopermeyer picks the leading order of that expansion in multiples. And the leading order, and keep the dipole terms. And then you get that H will be H0 plus E X times E T X. Of course, plus corrections of higher order multiples, but Mary Gopermeyer stayed here. This model has the advantage that it's explicitly, there's no object here that looks gauge independent. Now, interesting enough, remember how different this is from the Coulomb gauge, right? Because in the Coulomb gauge, we canceled U, right? And here, all that we have is a U. You people agree? This is a potential, a scalar potential. We don't have an A. Agreed everyone? So that's super interesting. And why is this so cool? And this is something that was not really understood well until the 70s, or even, let me just tell you exactly when. I don't really have it. Okay, it was not understood until, so there's three people that you may have heard about. Lamb, the person behind the Lamb shift. Scully, a person famous for in quantum optics, wrote a book. And Schlichter, I don't know him though. And they actually figured out what was going on here properly. Because people, okay, now we have two models, right? Two models for the light-matter interaction. This in quantum optics, by the way, this is called D times E, usually. It's like, or X times C, one of the two, as opposed to P times A. You see, we have this model and this model. And allegedly, they're supposed to be different if we did things right, which remember, we didn't, but if we did things right, the two things are supposed to be the same, only one in a different gauge than the other, and perhaps, well, you did a square term neglection here, and here you did a multiple neglection, higher multiple neglection. So in the order of, in a calculation where the approximations are right, they should give the same results. People started doing calculations with both and figure out that they are different. They gave different results. By the way, the Gopper-Meyer model nailed the experiments. The P times I model didn't nail the experiments. Some of them were OK, some others weren't. So people started using the dipole model quite more often than the P times A model, which is kind of funny, right? Because it's like, OK, what's going on with the P times A? OK, any ideas? What's going on with the P times A? What is that problem? So let's see. When we do a gauge transformation, imagine that I have Schrödinger equation, OK? And I have a vector potential and a scalar potential, and I do a gauge transformation. Schrödinger equation, is it invariant? Should it be invariant under gauge transformations? What do you think? Some of you know, hopefully. Schrödinger equation should be invariant under gauge transformations. The laws of physics cannot depend on a mathematical choice. In order for Schrödinger equation to be invariant under gauge transformations, since the Hamiltonian is not gauge invariant, the wave functions, the state vectors, have to be non-gauge invariant. When you do a gauge transformation, you've done this in quantum theory, I assume. When you do a gauge transformation, let me just try to. Nice. If you do a gauge transformation, takes psi to e to the IE tx psi. When you apply a gauge transformation on the field, you also need to apply a gauge transformation to the state vector. And that's kind of interesting, because what they were doing with the P times A is, oh, let's take the position representation, and whenever I get an X psi, I write the wave function of the electron, and that wave function they took from the books that solve Schrödinger equation. Now, Schrödinger equation in the books is solved in a very funny condition. When you solve Schrödinger equation, you are picking a gauge. You see, that Schrödinger equation that I wrote there is under certain conditions that you are picking a gauge to solve. In particular, the condition is that there's no A. You see, there's no A vector in the, I wrote a V of X, so I didn't write an A. So it's typically said, in the absence of currents, you say classically, because that justifies there's no A. If you're a quantum, though, you're doomed, because you always have A, maybe in the vacuum state, so no currents, but still you have an A. There is an assumption made on the gauge in which the circular equation was solved. So the wave functions that you have in a book are in a particular gauge. And if you want to use a different gauge, you need to transform those wave functions. Agreed, people? You cannot just pick them from the book. You could pick them from the book if you only have a scalar potential. In a particular gauge, in fact, that gauge is called the dipolar gauge, which is an approximated gauge, which is the Poincaré gauge, approximated. It's not really a gauge transformation, but becomes a gauge transformation in the approximate sense under the conditions the dipole approximation works. And we will discuss this in a tutorial, so don't worry too much, because this has a lot of stuff that I'm going too fast about. But yeah, if we were in a gauge in which there's no A, then for sure the book Schrödinger equation solutions you can pick. Again, there's no gauge really that cancels A, but approximate gauges do. Okay, and look at this. In the dipolar gauge, you get only a potential term in the interaction Hamiltonian. There's no A. So with the dipolar gauge, you can actually use the wave functions that are in the books. If you use the wave functions for the Schrödinger equation that you got from the books that solve the hydrogen atom in quantum mechanics, there's a gauge choice made that is compatible with the dipolar gauge. And that is why Maria Goeppert-Mayer model was nailing the experiments. Scully, Lamb, and Slicher proved, I think 1979, that if you transform the wave functions to the Coulomb gauge, from the book to the Coulomb gauge, from the book, I mean book gauge, if you want, is just a hydrogen atom writing a Coulomb potential there. You transform those to the Coulomb gauge, they become horribly complicated, but you can solve still, and there's some approximations. And then they proved that then the amplitudes, not just the probabilities, even the transition amplitudes for the atom coincided with the Mary Goeppert-Mayer model and with the P times A Hamiltonian. Of course, you simplified a lot the Hamiltonian by taking the Coulomb gauge, but you put the complication in the wave function. That's what you did. It's not innocent to do that. Okay, it's a lot of discussion without math, though. Hope you are comfortable with it so far. Any questions? Okay, so people did, I mean, Aggie probably knows better than me. People did, I don't know in modern times anymore, but people did quantum noctis with P times A as well, right? Yeah, in the end it was, I mean, after Lamb, Scully, and so on, it was kind of settled, but I've still seen sometimes P times A. So this is kind of the right one to use for now. Let's see if it's the right one to use. At the very least, it reproduces experiments really well and doesn't have gauge problems. It's nice in the sense that it's explicitly gauge, written in terms of gauge-independent things, and that is nice. All right, so any questions? What time is it? Oh, wow, time flies. Yeah.
Probably you said it before, but
I need a bit louder.
Why is it that the Hamiltonian is the one that evolves your system?
Right, okay, yes. Yeah, so that's a good question, and it takes a while. So the Hamiltonian here, so here's the thing. If you have an atom if you assume that your Hamiltonian is of the form up there, and not a electron in a hydrogen atom, and then you ask, can I couple an electromagnetic field to this? A vector and a scalar field to this, and you say, okay, you cannot do it any way you want. I mean, you can think of many ways of coupling it. I can write terms all day, but then you say, okay, no, I want a term that still is compatible with the symmetries of space-time. As in, like, we require that the structure constants, you know, the structure constants of the Poincaré group involve H. And you want all the structure constants to be modified by your coupling. If you change your coupling, you're going to have time translations that are not consistent with the Poincaré symmetries of the theory. There's only one way to make them consistent, and the way is the minimal coupling. That's why this is the right Hamiltonian. That's what a theoretician will tell you, an experimentalist will tell you, oh, it does reproduce, it's the thing that translates me. But there's a reason, a fundamental reason for it. If you want to see more details about that, you can check Weinberg's Quantum Theory of Fields, Volume 1, when he does all these things, like talks about what forms of Hamiltonians preserve the symmetries of spacetime. Interesting enough, that's also the way that preserves the symmetries of Galilean spacetime. Coincidence, interesting. No, not coincidence, because it depends. Or at least the central extension of the Galilean group, which is a little bit tricky, but it's kind of nice. If you're interested in those things, it's a very nice mathematical physics problem. All right, more questions? Good. All right, so the one thing that I want to do before the end of the lecture is the heavy, oh, I forgot this, huh? Okay, fine, I'll erase this. Is to see what form this D times E, E times X times C Hamiltonian has once we work a little bit with it. So let's see. Let me write the interaction Hamiltonian in the interaction picture. The D here represents interaction picture. What is that? Well, this is just E to the I H0 HI in the Schrödinger picture, E to the minus I H0 T. OK? So that thing will add the free energies. If we span in a basis of eigenstates, it will give us the energies of those in a phase. That's the typical thing that you do in basic quantum mechanics. All right, so if we do that, we write then that the Hamiltonian is of the form, of course, is E x in the Dirac picture times E x in the Dirac picture. So let's expand, and we get, let's write this general Hamiltonian in terms of his matrix elements. So let's explicit the matrix elements of this. So you have a sum over I, a sum over j, and you get j. Let's say that this is, let's pick as j and I the eigenbasis of the free Hamiltonian. So I want the matrix elements of this operator in the eigenbasis of h0. Okay? So that's what I'm doing. I have x now in the Schrödinger picture, because I'm going to write the phase explicitly. Tx. Well, I wrote just x, right? But, well, you know what I mean, hopefully. Tx. And then I have here I. And I get what the H0 does, it just adds a phase with the energies of these two guys, one here and one here. So it's omega ij t, and then j I. The omega ij is the energy difference between level I and level j. Agreed, everyone? And this comes from these terms. Okay. All right, so what we can do now is insert the identity expressed as the spectral decomposition of identity in the position eigenbasis. So what people usually call, let's move to the position representation. Okay? So I insert the identity twice. I insert it here and here. And then I get that this is equal to E sum ij of integral d, let's say three dimensions. It's an hydrogen atom after all, prime. And then we get j x operator e t x operator, x prime, I. And then I get E, if I'm not forgetting, hopefully I'm not forgetting anything, omega ij t, and of course, j I. Agreed, everyone? So I inserted the identity here and here. Now, this is pretty easy, right? Because let's identify this thing. Oh, look at this thing. This thing and this thing are very easy to identify. This thing is, in particular, the I state wave function of x. This is a vector, of course, huh? All right. The wave function as a function of x prime. Agreed, people? This is the ith orbital, if you want, or state. I call them orbitals because that's the name we usually give to the eigenstates of the free Hamiltonian. So that's the wave function of this, of the orbital I, if you want. And this thing is the complex conjugate of the wave function of the orbital j. Right? Then this thing, right, is just x vector now, not an operator anymore, because this is an eigenstate of this. Eigenstate, you know what I mean. This is part of the spectrum, of the continuous spectrum. So calling eigenstate would be a mistake, but it's an abuse of language that we all use all the time. So this thing is this, right? Agreed, people? Then this thing is and now this is a function, not for operators, but of variables, of real variables. Nicely enough, this thing is a delta 3 of x minus x prime.
Shouldn't it be a prime inside the e?
Okay. Yes. Thank you. So we use the delta prime to do the integral over x prime. Sorry, delta prime. We use the delta to do the integral over x prime. And then we get the following result. What time is it? OK. We get E sum ij of the integral of dx d3x psi j conjugate x vector x psi I x dot e tx e to the I omega ij t j I. Oh, okay, let's look at this. Oh, I forgot that I cannot do that. I'll erase that. All right, so look at what we have here. We have a sum. To begin with, so this thing is, if you want, we can call this thing, well, we'll do it in a minute. So this thing is kind of, if you see, the atom is seeing the field, so it's coupling to the field, only in some area of space. It's not seeing the field at all points. It's seeing the field only in some area. How big is the atom? You see, how big is the atom depends on what you are coupling the atom to. According to the electromagnetic field, how big is the atom? Well, as big as the product of the excited state wave function, the ground state wave function, and then this x here. So this is the area in space where the detector is seeing, where the atom is seeing the field. All right, this is a region of space in which the atom is seeing the field. Now, the sum over I and j is an overkill. How many of you know about selection rules in atomic physics? These things have parity. So a matrix element like this is not non-zero for all j's and I. You can simplify a lot using conservation of angular momentum and parity considerations. So for example, you know that I to I is forbidden. Well, actually, like ground to ground is forbidden. So ground to ground is forbidden. Then you know that delta n has to be plus minus 1. Then you know that delta l has to be plus minus 1 or 0. Those are the selection rules of atomic. I'm not going to get into this. This is just evaluating this. Basically, you can do it all. Let's do these integrals and see which ones are 0 because of parity reasons. In other words, also, you need these kets become orthogonal when you do a multiple. This is a multiple expansion already done. So if you expand this in multiples, you're going to get, all right, this is vector angular momentum 1, angular momentum 1. So if you do conservation of angular momentum in here, you get that most of these guys are 0. So in particular, the sum would be restricted to, if I do I different from j, I'm not changing anything because it needs to be different from j in order to have a transition valid like that because of delta n has to be plus minus 1 and things like that. Let's simplify it to two levels. That's a common thing in quantum optics as well. And it's basically, well, I have a whole hydrogen atom, but I'm going to restrict myself to processes that only excite one level. OK, if I do that, to simplify things a lot, restrict into two levels. We get the following. We get that the Hamiltonian, so let's call the levels I can only be ground or excited, and so can j. Ground or excited, two levels, either ground state or excited. Let's call them ground state and excited state, the two levels of the atom we're focusing on. And if you restrict to two levels, of course, let me just call these operators E, G. What does this thing do? Oh, it raises the ground state to the excited state, right? Let me call it sigma plus. I mean, this is a two-dimensional quantum system, right? So SU2 ladder operators is what you're going to get. And ground E is sigma minus. Of course, you know all the properties of these guys, right? So sigma plus squared equals sigma minus squared equals the zero operator. All right? And restricting to two levels and writing them in this form, you get that H interaction in the interaction picture, it's equal to E integral dx. And then you get F vector x e to the I omega t. Omega I call now the difference between of energy between ground and excited. That's the energy gap of the detector, in this case of the atom, plus F star of x e to the minus I omega t. This goes with sigma plus. This goes with sigma minus. All right. E, G equals plus G, E equals minus. All right. And this thing multiplies E dx, where f of x, where this f of x, we call it the smearing vector, because it tells me the smearing of the detector in space. This thing is, of course, the star of the excited ground. Yeah, no, without star, the excited x and psi of the ground state x conjugate. That's the smearing vector. It tells me, yep.
Plus between those terms.
Yes. I guess my mind saw the plus in here somehow. Right. So this thing here, we can give it a name. We can call it d of t x. And we call it a dipole operator. If you want, it's a dipole density, you see? An atom understood as a dipole density, you get a dipole that is mirrored in space. It's a field of sorts. Okay, so the atom lives in time and space, it's localized in its wave. And it's not the wave function of the atom that gives you, because someone tells you, okay, in a transition, how big is the atom? Where does the atom live? You say, oh, well, whatever the wave function is. Modulus square of psi ground, not quite. Where the atom lives is this. So the atom sees, the field sees the atom in this extension, if you want. And this dipole operator allows me to write the Hamiltonian eventually as this. D3x, dipole operator. Sometimes the E is put inside the dipole, sometimes it's not. I'm going to go with not because of comparison with other things. I mean, technically, the dipole in physics requires the E be part of it. Dot E. And this is the light matter interaction, Hamiltonian, once expressed in the interaction picture. Now, one last step, which is the magic of canonical quantization now. I've done this assuming or taking E and A as classical fields, right? But you can do a canonical quantization process, which involves setting out, so you know how it works, right? You get the solution of Maxwell equations, you get a complete basis of solutions, you express the general solution as a combination of those. And then you demand, you promote the amplitudes of those modes in the general solution to operators so that they satisfy canonical commutation relationships. You can do that process here and hat the E now. Why did I wait? So could have I done it from the beginning? Yes, I could. But I didn't want to mix the hats because we're talking about different spaces, if you want. I didn't want to mix the center of mass degree of freedom of the atom with the E, with the internal degrees of freedom of the field. It can be done like this, no problem. It can be done the other way. The other way requires a bit more rigor when you write. And this E, you can, and I'll write here. Nah, I'll write it later. This E, I cannot move the board, right? But then I'll write it tomorrow because time is. But let's just discuss this. So you see how this Hamiltonian is, the dipole coupling Hamiltonian can be expressed as some dipole density times the field integrated on space. We're going to talk about the expansion of the field here and then how quantum optics dealt with that, because once you get here in quantum optics, standard quantum optics starts making approximations. And we're going to talk about them and how they are not compatible with relativity. So the reason why I use the name relativistic quantum optics when we do it right is because what people do in most quantum optics out there, not that they don't know better, I'm not going to say that, but what they do because they can work with that is do a set of approximations in here that completely destroy the relativistic nature of the model. And that's why quantum optics is not, textbook quantum optics is non-relativistic, no matter if they're working with light. So we will talk about simplifications of this model, and we will talk about the structure of this in the next lecture. Any questions? Yep.
For general gauge theories, are you always guaranteed to be able to write the Hamiltonian in a gauge invariant way?
No. And in fact, you cannot really, So the Poincaré gauge, you can take the Poincaré gauge, which is the closest you can get to write it in terms of gauge invariant things. So you can get almost gauge invariant things, as in like in some limits, they're in terms only of gauge invariant things. But no, in general, you won't be able to get rid of that. For electromagnetism, yes.
So to higher orders, it's still not gauge.
To higher orders, this thing in the electromagnetic way case, it is written in terms of E's and B's, but you get field squares terms. So you get so the nice thing about the Poincaré gauge, the dipolar gauge is, here's the thing, dipolar gauge is not really a gauge. It's an approximated gauge. It is a gauge transformation only if we assume that we're in a regime where the dipole approximation works. We can discuss that tomorrow as well. What's this approximation? When does it work? In general, what you have is the transformation of the Poincaré gauge that involves B. At the next order, you have B, and you have a B square. And then you get powers of the fields as well. Well, different multiples, not power, multilinear forms of the fields. And you get similar problems to this one, so you need to deal with them. The nice thing here, though, is that the approximation that we did here to get something that is explicitly gauge invariant and not quadratic terms is not a small charge kind of approximation. What we did here is a dipole approximation. Here, to neglect the second order terms in E, you are doing small e kind of approximation. Here, what we're doing is a dipole kind of approximation, which is different in nature. E could be strong. This could be non-perturbative and still work and be a good approximation. The dipole approximation is related. So in books, it's typically explained, if the wavelength of the transition you're considering is large as compared to the size of the atom, then it's valid. That is also not satisfactory, because imagine that you're looking at vacuum fluctuations. What's the dominant wave of the field? There's no wavelength of the field that is dominant in this process. In fact, we'll talk about that tomorrow. But what you can do, you can prove that the dipole approximation is good as long as you look at interaction times that are much smaller. Okay, first, angular momentum doesn't play a big role in your physics that you're doing, and you look at interaction times that are comparable with the light crossing time of the, so much larger than the light crossing time of the atom. Basically, it's saying, I don't want to see the shape too much of the atom. So I wait enough time for the shape to be blurry. The higher multiples, it's not about the size of the atom. This accounts for the size. This thing accounts for the size and some shape, like the kind of like shape in terms of asymmetries between anisotropies of the atom. This accounts for it. But if you want to resolve the fine shape of the atom, then you need more multiples. And when do you start needing those multiples? Well, when you're looking at times that are comparable to the light crossing time of the atom. I'll talk a little bit about that tomorrow as well. But really good questions. Anything else? All right. So I'm being a little bit again, and I will be outrageous tomorrow because I'm going to start claiming that in quantum optics things are wrong. So hopefully Aggie will keep me in check, like, and all of you. And it's going to be fun, I hope. And that's it. I will continue tomorrow. Thank you for indulging me for 5 minutes more than you should.